Welcome to Back in the Grind, a podcast about life, music, people, and the stories that bring us closer. Chances are, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you're already familiar with today's guest. His name's Brendan, but he's better known as Punk with a Camera. He's worked with many of the musicians we had on this podcast to help them release videos on YouTube. In this conversation, we delve into his early life and some of the difficulties he had growing up at home. We talk about the first camera he ever got, a busted up camera his dad ran over, and how he developed a passion for film, and then later connected that with the DIY punk community, which was one of the first places he felt at home in his life. We also talk about the role of money in all these things. In the DIY punk and folk punk world, it's often a subject that most people are uncomfortable discussing, but the reality is, it's a part of what we're doing as far as putting out records or trying to go on tour. Money plays a role in those things, and most of them wouldn't happen without it. And that's just the society we live in right now. There's no way of avoiding that. But we so often avoid the discussion and find it uncomfortable. But not having that discussion often allows others to take advantage of the things that we're creating and putting out into the world. But the more we can stop others from taking advantage of us, the more we can give back to the community that we're trying to build. So I think it's an important conversation to be had. We also talk about just simply starting to follow your passion and put it out into the world, starting to be comfortable with the fact that you're probably going to fuck up at some point, but it's okay because you're going to learn. It was a refreshing conversation for me because since I've been released from prison, I've been restarting so many things in my life and starting completely new things, like the coffee company I've talked about before, and I have plans to open a cafe and music venue in the future. All things that make me uncomfortable. So it was nice to hear someone else who's followed their passion into a place that seems to be working for them and helping others do the same. And we end talking about pythons and platypus. So enjoy this episode of Back in the Grind as we bring you closer to Punk with a Camera. Brendan, thanks for coming on the show. I wanted to start off getting into some history of what your life was like growing up when you were younger.
Of course. My name's Brandon. I'm 27 years old. And since, wow, it's been about a decade. Since I was about 17, I've gone by the public artist name Punk with a Camera. And it all started because I think my dad ran over a camera when I was like 11. And it was all busted, but it still worked. And the kids in my neighborhood, I wanted to like film skate kids, but nobody skated. They all did BMX. And I did those videos for a while and then popped up and took all the classes in middle school and high school to learn more. Just got really interested in it and got introduced to punk music and just kept going to shows and taking photos and videos. And some kid came up to me and, you know, gave me like the name. And it's been kind of crazy ever since. I've just been trying my best to figure out a way how to do this, actually make films full time, but also try to survive where, you know, I'm not working a 9-to-5 or doing what I can and trying to find that balance with art to continue to have the same passion when I was like 17 starting this shit.
Yeah, I was aware, I read somewhere that your dad had ran over the first camera you had. How did that happen? Like, how does your dad run over the camera?
My dad had a concrete company before I was born where he would pour foundations and do specialty concrete. He's always been an artist. That's what I told him the other day because he's like into woodworking now. And I'm like, Dad, you know, you're like an artist, right? You didn't just pour concrete. You did specialty stamp and all this other crazy chemical shit. And it was pretty. And he was like, yeah, I guess you're right. But yeah, he would have to take photos for the city to get approved and stuff like that. And he always had some type of bullshit point and shoot camera. And, you know, we all make mistakes. I think he had it on his bumper or on his tire and he just ran over, I think, a Canon Prixma silver, like, you know, the lens comes out when you turn it on camera. And it like messed up the screen that would show the photos. So to him, it was completely useless and he was going to throw it away. And I grabbed it and it had a video function that did, I think, 360 or 480p and like 20. Anywhere between like 2011, 2012, maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to manually think how old I am at that point. But, you know, I was like 10 years old and I got my first camera and I just started playing with it.
So you got this busted up camera that you were still able to use. And you said some of the first things you started filming were kids on BMX bikes.
Yeah, I grew up in two places because my parents were divorced, but my mom's house, she got real lucky. She like got slammed by a truck or something and was able to get enough insurance money to get a down payment on a pretty good house in a place called Kingwood, Texas. She got a foreclosure, and about 2 miles down the street from that house, there was a skate park that had, I think, like a 6-foot drop in, a little slide, or what's that called? Like the rail where it's just like a couple steps up and there's a rail mm-hmm. down. And I think one more ramp. It was a very small, simple, not even a quarter acre, maybe an eighth acre skate park. And I really thought skating was cool. I've, you know, played Tony Hawk on the N64 and PS2 and shit. And I wanted to do skate videos because I would watch them and do everything. But the problem with that area was some people were there and they could afford their house, and other people were there and it was just cheaper to have like a bigger house. How do I say that? Like, it was, people had nice houses, and then there was a small section where you either were in an apartment or you had like an older, one of the first houses built in that area. So all these dudes had $3,000 to $5,000 BMX bikes. And I was just like, you guys don't even skate, but okay. You know, they would still do cool tricks and we'd shoot little videos and it was a ton of fun. Yeah, that's where it started. I got really enthralled in it. I just remember getting bullied because I had like a Walmart bike.
So did you know what you were doing with the camera at that time, or were you just on your own fooling around and filming people doing tricks and bikes?
When you played those video games and stuff, they'd have the little sections where they would have the skate things with the fish eyes, and I was really enthralled by those, and I would like play the video games and be like, well, I could probably do that. I just want to find somebody who skates like that, which, you know, those are pro level skaters. That's not happening. But I'd go out to the little parks and I'd record people and I'd try my best from there.
You end up becoming punk with a camera. I'm just curious where the punk came in. I didn't play video games too much, but I know a lot of times they had like a punk soundtrack to a lot of those skating games. Is that where that came in, or where did the whole punk side of things come in for you?
Funny enough, someone gave me like a Days and Days CD when I was in high school, and I think they had just released Rogue Taxidermy and it started blowing up, but they were still doing 5 shows a week just everywhere. And I would go after school and I would be like one of the 7 people at some of these shows, and some of the shows would be bigger, but just the era in which they were playing like really small shows and it was really intimate. There'd be like at Black Barbie, and there was this house that people would go to all the time, and there was a ton of houses like that, you know, they come up and they come down. But getting into DIY punk, I've been in it since I was like 16, and it was bands like Days and Days in the Houston community that really got me involved in all that.
So a lot of that was the logistics of like you living in a place where they were also from that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how'd you transition then from filming kids on BMXs to filming punk musicians or folk punk musicians? Like, what was that path like? Was it just one directly into the other, or was there a shift over time gradually?
I think it was a bit of a shift. I had always been enthralled with music in some way or form from the first time I went to a concert. I think my second concert was actually like Ozzy Osbourne. And I remember being in middle school in the broadcasting stuff, being like, these are the big shows that are happening. And I would also be the editor in my middle school's paper as well. And I would write the music section and I would talk about different things that were going on. It was kind of like that gradual shift. And once I got into high school, I continued the video side of things. And I think I took a photojournalism class every now and again. But it was basically like I would put up with these people that I just didn't connect with because, like, yeah, my mom got lucky and got a house in Kingwood, but, you know, I spent a lot of time at my dad's house in Porter, which is a completely different area. And the people that went to that high school were like just one level below private, and they had a really good film program in a high school because of it, but it was the only thing that made me finish high school because it's the only thing I was interested in. But essentially, yeah, I took all the resources that I could from the middle school journalism and broadcasting classes into high schools. Like every single AV class that they had, I took them all. I learned how to edit. I learned how to play with Photoshop and do all these little graphics things. And from there, I would take the camera rentals that the high school would give out. Because when we first started, we had what were called mini DV tapes, which you'd have to like manually batch your footage and do all this other shit. But by the time I was in 10th grade, we got the Rebel Series DSLRs, and DSLRs started to really do their thing because, you know, I'm a child of the industrial camera revolution and technology revolution in general, like how quickly things got better. And, you know, we went from tape to digital by the end of high school, and it was pretty crazy. And a lot of fun, and I learned a lot from it. And I would just use these resources that were allotted to me from these high schools that I didn't even want to be at. And I would go to punk shows and I would film people, and eventually got into doing the DIY session stuff that I'd been doing for a really long time, which is just me and my friend from high school just going out and trying to record bands in this back room that I had in my dad's house at New Caney. Yeah, it was just a really fun thing to do to learn how to get better at stuff. And it's the only thing I could do. It was the only fun thing to do. Everything was pretty boring otherwise. I didn't want to go to school.
In my kid's garage, when I found these old, and I believe they were like what you were describing, they were like mini, they looked like a little tiny VHS. I had a little handheld camcorder. And for some reason, the thing got fucked up. This was back in like 2002, maybe I got it. And at a certain point, it stopped recording video, but it was still taking in audio. But anyways, I found like 3 or 4 of those tapes from like, oh, they're written on them, 03, 04 era. They say Johnny Hobo and the Freight Trains and some live shows that were there. But I have no way to play them back. I don't know if they're just audio, if those ones have the video on them. But it would be kind of cool to actually like figure out a way to get those onto, you know, somehow I can hear them or see them again.
You can do one of two things. If you want, one, you could mail it to me and I could just import them for you. Mm-hmm. But essentially, you can take a mini FireWire, you know, like a printer cable. You've got the mm-hmm. FireWire 400, and I think FireWire 600 is the smaller one. You know, you're getting into old tech at that point. You plug that into a program like Adobe Premiere, and you run what's called a batch, and it manually transfers anything that the viewfinder plays back through the tape, and that's audio and video. And that'd be pretty cool to digitize an interesting point in history of that genre of music. As long as the tapes are not degraded, they're just like vinyl, you know, keep them safe from heat, you should be fine.
I'll be honest, there's a good chance maybe I'll just end up sending them to you, because you know, you're more likely to find me sitting at the edge of a swamp than you are to find me playing with wires and stuff. I'm just, that's not my area.
Oh, man, I am a sucker for old vintage technology. Mm-hmm. Now that I've gotten to a point in my life where, like, my living situation is stable and I can actually collect things, I've been getting really into VHS tapes and Laserdiscs. Man, I just love old things, because I couldn't have any of that stuff when I was younger. So it's just like, now I'm older, I remember this stuff, and now I want to, mm-hmm. you know, kind of go back to that area. There's such a time passage with old media that's just comfortable.
You know, it was an interesting time period when I had that little handheld camcorder. Obviously, I'm involved with the folk punk world mostly, but the way that music was being presented and moved around in the world, you know, how that technology affected it at that time was very interesting. And then, you know, you look at nowadays, where when we started DIY Bandits and recording music with Pat, like, YouTube wasn't even a thing yet. It didn't exist. Like, mm-hmm. MP3s were just coming out. Like, the first iPods were coming out at the time. You know, there was no streaming.
The Zunes.
And there was like no streaming. So it was a very interesting time period. I go back and forth on like how things affect music nowadays versus back then. I mean, obviously there's some nostalgia for me, but also it's interesting because back then there was a requirement for more face-to-face human contact for transporting or sharing of music. And nowadays it's a lot easier to discover music outside of interacting with the local community, in a sense.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side, you know, you could be introduced to the local community because you're finding music through streaming or online. So it goes both ways.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember when I first got interested in cassette tapes, because I actually make my own for the Punk with a Camera label, or I guess Ribfest. I've never even looked up the band, but it's like my favorite tape to listen to. It just says Twister, and I think it's got a girl with a crop top on it. And I remember my friend Nina from France mailed it to me with one of hers, and I was like, this shit rips. And I would just listen to it constantly, and it was my favorite thing. And sometimes when I'm back over, we used to do the DIY sessions, I put like one of those, I found one of those like cassette holders that you screw into the mm-hmm. wall, and it puts like 100 in there, and I would just pull it out when I'm working in there, and I'd play that Twister album. Yeah, it's like you find a tape that just has a song on it that really, that hits you. I remember, I think for CDs for that, got really into not Little B, but his side project. Oh, fuck. It's got like, got my Vans on it, but I don't wear sneakers. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the Bass God.
Okay.
And that just came from a random CD I found. I'm like, damn, this shit slapped the pack. That's what it was called. And I remember even reaching out to Little V and I'm like, do you like own the rights to this? Because this was never put onto vinyl and I would love to make that happen. I just love this CD.
You mentioned like not being able to have some of that stuff when you were growing up and you want to get it now. You know, did you just mean like you couldn't afford it back then?
There's a couple things. My parents were kind of weird. I don't know. They were pretty neglectful. It wasn't like crazy, super duper abusive, but it, you know, if I was out of line, I'd get the shit kicked out of me. But it wasn't like I'd had black eyes or anything. It was just like these people who work themselves to death got this child who needs special needs because they're fucking ADHD autistic and they can't sit still in a classroom and they don't understand why everything is just too loud or too annoying or too whatever. And the system that's in place, you know, I think I was in special ed classes until high school because they were just like, oh, this kid just can't sit still. And, you know, I had video games when I was a kid, but they got rid of all of them because at one point when I was like 9 years old, I got into a lot of trouble because I got kicked out of 13 different daycares and my parents couldn't figure it out until they realized that I was on adult levels of experimental Ritalin. So I'm like extremely mad all the time. And like, I don't want to use the word coked out, but some level of, you know, like my 10-year-old body is not considering its actions, and I would just be put in a place with a daycare and I would just beat up kids because I'd felt weird. And I was like 10 years old, I was like 7, and their response to my behavior pattern, because they thought that I'd be some type of criminal or something, would be like to shave my head or take all my stuff away. And I remember, like, for a large portion of my life I just had an empty room with a bed and no items. And I think my exposure to music was like 2 CDs. It was like a Jack Johnson album for On and On and an AC/DC live album, and those were like my possessions. And I had to hide those. Now I'm older and there's nothing holding me back. I grow my hair out long because they can't shave it. And I want to own the games I once had and go back to a time where things were simpler. And I recently tracked down the PS1 Scooby-Doo Cyber Chase, and just physically having it, I bought it at a Goodwill for like $6. I don't know. It brought back some peace. It's a weird thing that stuff can do when you don't have a lot of it, whether it's, you know, you just can't afford it or it's been taken away from you. I don't know. Yeah, it's like, I hope I'm not a hoarder, but it just helps.
You had mentioned like your parents were just like working all the time and neglectful. And, you know, I guess you mentioned the word abusive to a certain extent.
Yeah.
So it didn't seem like you fit in or had a place to fit in so much at home. And while you're at school, you kind of hinted at maybe that wasn't an easy place to fit in either. Like, did you feel like you didn't fit in anywhere for like a portion of your childhood?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's the only thing that saved me was DIY punk. That's why I'm such a big proponent of all ages spaces. And if you look at like my early days of touring, I remember getting into arguments with people where I was like, you should tour DIY because these kids need a place to go to shows. And people were like, we can't make any money. And so I said, fuck you. I'm going to prove you wrong. And like anything I've ever done in my life has been out of spite of somebody telling me I can't do it. So I remember like I booked 2 successful tours that helped me through my early days of college, that I would just do the shows. And I made sure that there were always all ages and I wouldn't take anything on that wasn't, I don't know, it's just, if I didn't have those spaces at 16 to 17 to 18, because at that point, man, like the combination of not feeling safe in my own house and not feeling welcomed in a schooling situation and not really having anything to do because of my location and inability to really get around, I probably wouldn't be here. And punk gave me a space of community that allowed me to realize, well, I'm an artist. You know, I'm not a fucking 9-to-5 person. I want to make art, and I've been finally put into a space where I can be myself and work on the things that I want to do, and I've never looked back ever since I made that realization.
You said if you didn't find the DIY punk space, you probably wouldn't be here. What did you mean by that?
I'd have killed myself, just being honest, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of my friends have, you know. I got a lot of phone numbers I can't text anymore, and it comes down to the circumstance of, you know, some people might be in pain that they just need a release, and some people just feel like there's nowhere to go. And I got very fortunate at a young age to know two things, know that I wanted to be a filmmaker and know that I had a space in which I could feel safe and become a filmmaker and do things in. And, you know, those early years are rough. You know, you can ignore them, but when you reflect on them, you can go back and you're like, oh, wow, yeah, I guess that shit did suck.
Yeah, your story makes a lot more sense to me right now, just hearing, like, you know, you've gotten this busted up camera your dad ran over at an age, you know, your younger age where you're kind of figuring out who you are, but you're also realizing you don't fit in at home or at school. And then you fall into the punk world while you're fooling around with this camera. And then you find that place where you feel like you fit in and that the two come together, the camera and the fitting in within this DIY punk world. To see what you're doing now, it kind of really makes sense to me.
Yeah. You know, my goals in the future are to keep doing it, but on a, you know, not on a busted up camera level. I want to start making really thought-provoking forms of media, whether it's short films, movies, documentaries, etc. But the only problem being is, you know, growing up in a working class family, you know, like my parents divorced when I was like 7 or 8, I think. And my dad ran a construction company where he would do residential concrete work. And my mom was a single teacher. So they didn't exactly have the connections. And I didn't exactly have, you know, the home funding to go to film school or be with people within these industries. And the two options for filmmaking when you don't have that is to, there's the classic try your best, move to LA, figure it out, or try your best in a scene and get opportunities out where, or focus on trying to build a brand and kind of become your own executive producer. So that way, whatever you wanted to make, you could make. And if it didn't work out, it didn't matter because you're the one who funded it. And that's kind of the route that I want to go because I prefer the freedom of punk. I've been working really hard on it. I'm 27 now, and I'm at a point where that's the next stage. You know, from since the pandemic, I've been running a printing shop. It was really just to, so I could quit my jobs, because at my peak, I was 3 jobs and college at the same time, because my parents were like, if you didn't do something with your life, you're kicked out. So I was like, well, if I go to college and I can pay what I can, it'll give me a little bit of time to just try to get on my feet and go from there. Because otherwise, you know, I'm just going to be back into the same spot I was when I was 15 and just fucking miserable and not sure what to do with my life. And now I don't have 3 jobs. And I did finish school. I told myself when I was 18, I was like, Brandon, you're going to make 2 decisions. You're either going to be an artist or you're going to go to college and you're going to put your energy 50-50 into that. And whatever does better by the end of it, that's what you're going to do. And I did what I could, you know, like, community college was pretty affordable. You could take 4 classes for a whole semester for like $600. But once I finished that and started going to state college, and, you know, the same thing of like, put up with the abuse of your parents to, you know, still have a place to live, but also go forward with your future. It's like a weird balancing act that a lot of us have to do. Yeah, once you got to the state level, it was like, I couldn't afford to take a full ride. I had to like go on tour and try to raise the money to get like 2 classes for a semester, because even that was like $6,000. It was crazy.
You grew up, your parents were divorced. You know, you were having, I guess it would be fair to say, like a rough time within that family structure. And then you get to a point where your parents kind of say, I think you said you're 18, you got to either get your shit together or get out. And then, you know, you proceeded to do all this work to create the things you have now. What is your parents' relationship with you now? Like, what are they supportive of what you're doing? Are they?
I'm no contact with my mother. She's always been abusive to me. The biggest thing, and I've been in therapy for about 3 years now, and the biggest thing that I've been teaching myself this year is that it's okay to make mistakes and be wrong, because for so long of my life, I was treated as a criminal and I had to be an overachiever. I had to do all these things. I remember like, nothing was ever good enough for her. I would be like, dude, I've got 3 jobs. I'm in college. I'm pursuing all this shit that I'm doing, and I'm doing good at all of it. And you still are doing crazy shit. Like, at one point, I remember she put a deadbolt on the bathroom door because I didn't clean it good enough. And I'm like, at what point, when you have full-time college and 3 jobs, am I supposed to sleep, let alone eat food and do all this other stuff? So it was just like, it took to a breaking point, and the breaking point was she killed my dog, or she put my dog down when I wasn't there. And granted, the dog was a little bit older, but it wasn't his time. And it just made me realize at that point that I've done what I can, and staying under her roof is, you know, the balance of, well, it becomes a little bit more affordable to finish this college shit and be an artist and have the freedom to come back from that. But the trade-off, you know, you're dealing with extreme amounts of emotional abuse and constant threats of your shit will be out in the lawn and all this other stuff. And thankfully, at that point, after doing the grind in which I was doing for so long, I could afford to move in with a friend of mine. And I never looked back. I haven't talked to her since. Sometimes I stop by the house and just pick up mail that gets delivered to me, but it's never more than, all right, is something there? Okay, bye. Because, you know, you deal with so much bullshit from somebody that, you know, I never had family. I had adoptive, like, punk parents. And that's where I went for family. You know, I had my adopted mother, Ella, who's an amazing trans woman who gave me a wonderful perspective on what that life was like from a really early age, because she was at first my adoptive father figure. And I had my punk parents, Eugene and Jamie, who that was their thing. They just took in all the neighborhood kids because everyone's parents were like my mom, and they just gave them a safe space to be kids. And that's all we needed. And I think there's such an important role with these like familial punk parental things, which I'm finding out later as I get older is like fucking totally normal. And now I'm 27 and there's like younger kids that like I check in with and I'm like, how are you doing, dude? Like, are you okay? Do you need anything? Cause I realize like there's like a weird passing of the torch when it comes to the understanding that a lot of people in this subgenre don't come from the best homes, and that these shows are, I don't know, it's just, it's what makes us move forward.
I find this stuff very interesting. I mean, what you were just talking about is a big part of why I do this podcast. In the 90s, I was, you know, listening to punk and getting into it. But by the late 90s, I was becoming active in that world. So, yeah, I agree 100%. It's something that's a lot of kids in this subculture are, you know, not necessarily in the same boat as you where they're escaping something, but just looking for something more than what they have access to at home.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is anything that you would even consider and if you would have an answer, but if your mom was to like sit down and actually listen to you, you know, if you can have a conversation with her where she would take in what you were saying, what would you want her to know about what things were like for you? Or who you are.
I've been very fortunate enough to have a therapist for the last 3 years. And, you know, that's just one of the big topics we talk about. And it comes down to the fact that at 27, I'm still learning basic social skills because of the neglect of her as a person and realizing that, oh, she's a narcissist. You know, like everything that she's done to you is so traumatic to her. It was just like a random Tuesday. And I've had to try those conversations, and she would always blow them off or do whatever with them. And I'd be like, you shaved my head because I acted up in class once, or you would pull me out of class and beat the shit out of me with a paddle as if that did anything. And I know you were trying your best as a mother, but there wasn't any growth. Like I'm trying to be close with my dad, you know, like he's probably the most supportive thing. And the reason why Punk with the Camera is still going is he didn't know how to be a father. His dad wasn't there either, but he saw that I had the same drive as him as not only an artist, but somebody who just wants to do shit, and he would facilitate things. You know, like our print shop is still on his property. It's this 300 square foot garden shed that I put walls down onto. And, you know, he was like, you want to start a small business? You know, like I'll help you out. You know, I'll give you a space to do it. You just got to pay for the stuff and go from there. But my mom has always just been like, I'm like a nothing more than a child support check to her. It's been, you know, the whole life. And I have like friends like Jesse from Days and Days, and I see like their parents and how supportive they are. And I'm like, damn, that is so sick. And I see compersion through that. And I'm like, in the same breath, I have other friends who have that same support and they don't have a positive relationship. And I'm like, dog, you don't know how good you have it. Fuck. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a weird one. Sorry. Am I on the right topic?
Yeah, no, these are things that I'm interested in talking about. I mean, it's a big part of this podcast is we do get into how people can move through life in a way that makes it more comfortable and easier for them. So it's not just we're going to be talking about music. You know, that's not our goal, is to let other people know they're not alone in their experiences.
Yeah.
And hopefully offer, you know, something that can help them find a better place or path for themselves.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, the biggest thing being is that it could have been a lot worse and they did the best that they could. It's just, you know, there's just certain levels that you can't go past. I'm grateful that I always had like a roof over my head and shit. But it always felt like a, like rent. Mm-hmm.
So let's get a little more into Punk with a Camera and the start of that. Do you remember what was the first Punk with a Camera video that you recorded?
Kind of. So like, I actually changed the YouTube name in high school because I would upload some of the clips. I think if you look, my oldest clip is like my buddy Christian playing a Legend of Zelda guitar medley for a talent show, because that was like the Creekwood and the Kingwood High School had the musical talent shows, and there was a couple of kids I would just like help them out, do videos, etc., or like try to document it. And I think once I got the actual Punk with a Camera name from going to the shows, and I decided that, I think I was watching like A Fistful of Vinyl or somebody else who was already doing session work and being like, that sounds cool, I want to try that. There's cool people that I'm surrounded by. And that tour through Houston. And I think it was this kid who lived in like close to me. I think his name was Skyler, and his band, they were like 19 trying to figure it out. And we just did a recording session. And I think there was like a post-hardcore metal band or something like that as well. And we kind of just like did them and saw where our mistakes were and just kept doing them until we like got it down to a science. And that's just kind of the way it was for a while. And I would get into like doing music videos and everything else. And it's like screen printing, you know, like it's a lot at first, but then you kind of make a ton of mistakes. And as long as you look at a mistake as a learning opportunity and not like, oh, I'm stupid. And, you know, take something positive out of fucking up, you'll get so much better at your craft, you know?
I mean, in the beginning of something, when you're not familiar with it, or it's not an area or a territory that you're specifically extremely knowledgeable about, because like you said, you're going to make mistakes. It's going to be intimidating. But if you can get over that hump, like you said, there comes a point where, and often you don't even realize it, but you've gathered so much knowledge, and that, you know, you can kind of look back and see how far you've come. But it's hard to take those initial steps in the beginning.
Yeah. And I've got a lot of friends who I keep telling them, I'm like, I'm not good at any of this, but I'm not scared to fuck up. And I have a lot of, I guess it's like guilt that we've done as well as we have, because I've met so many talented people. But it's like I meet with these talented people, and some of them are just like so scared of fucking up that they prevent themselves from doing anything. I'm like, dude, that's the beauty of it. I'm not good at any of this, but I will be, and I just got to keep trying at it. And you know, you can't expect that the first time you do something that you'll do great. I mean, you might have a good run or you might do something okay, but you harm yourself so much by not trying. I think that's like an important thing to understand when all you want to do is go out and do something that is scary and is out of the norm, that you can't just look up on a Reddit forum and figure it out.
You know, I find myself in this position now. I mean, I've gotten out of prison and I'm kind of rebuilding my life, and I have this idea to open this cafe, like a coffee roastery cafe with a venue in the back. And I kind of been stagnant like this last year. I mean, I'm making steps, but like for me, like I have that fear of just pushing myself in a direction, and I know what direction I need to go, what things I need to do, and I've been like avoiding them. But recently, like things have been happening, you know, where we spoke outside of this interview, like people are coming after me for the name of the coffee company I have. And
oh, yeah,
it sucks. But I see that now, like, all right, this is an opportunity for me to start doing the things I didn't do originally and to push the company in a direction I wanted to go, so that eventually, you know, I can end up opening this space that will be a place where people can gather, especially like within the DIY punk community, and have like an all ages venue. And that's my goal. You know, it's a several year goal. It's hard. Even with this podcast, I didn't know what the hell I was doing when I started this podcast. I had no clue. I think I booked the first six guests before I even knew like how to record a podcast.
Yeah.
Like I had no clue how to do it. You know, even I mentioned on here before, like I running a record label, like I didn't do any recording. I was totally unfamiliar with that world. Obviously people help you and you figure things out as you go. But the concept of just starting, like sometimes you just wherever you are, you just got to start.
Yeah.
It really takes off from there if you can get over that initial fear.
And I tell friends all the time, because like I have a friend of mine, Addison, she's probably one of my oldest friends. I think that we started hanging out when I must have been 15 or 16 and she must have been 14 or 15. And we were the two punk kids, you know, we're the only ones who had patches on them. And she would watch what I was doing and she's like, I want to do that. And she's a really good pen and paper artist for the longest time. She actually made like one of the earliest sketches for an Escape from the Zoo design. And she's like doing tattooing stuff right now. And she's like, you're so lucky. You have all this reaction and all this other stuff. And I'm like, well, I've just been doing it. You know, I don't want to be hard on you when I say like, you just got to keep grinding at it and trying at it and then being involved with people who do similar stuff to you and then working together on that. You know, like we were talking about how some company was like going to send you some type of sue letter because they have the name. And I was like, I've gotten, you know, letters from Warner Brothers. I'm fully into my rights. This person just doesn't want your name to be up on the thing. And having that support, that feedback, that grounding from other people is one of the biggest things that came along with the journey of just being into this and finding people with similar mindsets that can give you that feedback, that way you're not just in your head. Because if you're in your head, you're just like, oh, I won't do shit. I won't be whatever. But then I can pop back over here and be like, hey, Pepe, everything you've been doing with like the artist give back and the stuff that you want to do is in the right fucking thing. And there are people that I've met along the way that you should talk to. And, you know, that's what makes all the difference. Because once you get started, other people will see it. And I tell people this is like, once you put it into the ether, there's going to be someone out there that wants to support it because you're just doing it. And there are a lot of people that want to do it and they can't because of whatever circumstances, but they will be supportive of other people that they see doing it. And it's beautiful.
No, totally. You know, I'm glad we had that conversation a couple weeks back too about what I was dealing with, because I had just recently gotten that information when I talked to you. And I was in my head. I was freaking out. I'm like, oh, this whole thing is falling apart. Like my vision to rebuild after I got out of prison is all coming to an end because of this, you know, stupid cease and desist letter. And you and I had that conversation and it really helped me gain some perspective on the situation. It kind of took a lot of the fear out of it for me. And now I'm like in a place where I'm comfortably, or, you know, there's some discomfort, but I'm comfortable with moving forward and I'm not going to give up. So yeah, thank you for that conversation, by the way.
Yeah, the support that you can find through strangers and friends you make along the way is probably the most important thing that I've taken away from anything I've ever done.
Yeah, and to your earlier point, like you were saying to your friend, I think it was Ashley, perhaps.
Addison.
You know, I mean, you got to keep grinding. I've said it a couple times, but you got to do stuff, and sometimes it's going to suck. Things are not going to go well, and I mean, I was doing things for years before anything took off. But if you stick at it for that long, people begin to recognize like, oh, this person is serious about the thing they're doing. Like, oh, this person obviously loves the thing they're doing and they're trying to support the community. Or I don't know. I think we often see other people, like someone might see you and what you created, but they don't understand like the years of essentially struggle that went into it and all the gritty hard work that took place. They just see like you built this thing and it's like, oh, he's at the top of this mountain. And it's like, well, there was a long journey to get there.
Yeah. And, you know, as an update on Addison, she went and she apprenticed in a podunk town for a little bit. And she kind of skipped a step and got a personal studio in Houston. And granted, she is still trying to figure it out, but she is doing so well and she is learning so much and she is becoming so much better at an artist now that she's started that fucking snowball. And I have full faith in my friend that she's going to see great success, that she'll start doing tattoo conventions soon, that she'll start having real name recognition. And it comes down to the fact that, you know, as long as you grind on things, and don't get me wrong, things can fail, but as long as you take as much perspective as you can, get as much feedback from other places, learn from it, and figure out the formulas and solutions that make sense. You know, there is such an opportunity of self-sufficiency through art, and I know that she will achieve it, and I'm so proud of her.
The other thing that you had mentioned, the give back to the community stuff I was doing, and this kind of touches on another important point of a lot of the things that ended up being successful for me was one of the main goals when I started getting involved in this type of community in the DIY world, the folk punk world, the punk underground, was to just help people get to where they're going. And, you know, that's when I started meeting musicians of all kinds. I thought, what can I do to help them get to where they're going? And I mean, one, I didn't know how to play music. I didn't know how to record. I never ran a record label. These were, you know, but I just thought, well, I can take these steps to help do something that they're not doing, whether it's come up with the funding to put out an album, or like in the instance of Chesky, like I loved what he was doing. And I could kind of see there was a crossover where he can be accepted in the folk punk world. And, you know, and I pushed for 3 years for Pat to do that split with him. Pat was like hesitant at first, but, you know, actually they became great friends and we ended up doing that split, but just helping people to get where they're going. And I never did that seeking credit or attention, but word gets out. And it was funny because, like you just pointed out, like even now since I've gotten out of prison, you know, and I owe money to the government, the federal government is like IRS and all these bullshit I got to deal with. I'm still on federal probation, but there's money coming in from like the Johnny Hobo streaming stuff that Pat didn't put up. I wasn't even going to put it up. I wasn't interested, but he said, people keep doing it. And he said, you know what, Pepe, you should put it up. If anyone should get the money, it should be you. But my thought was, I just wanted to give that money back to the community. I'm not pocketing any of that. And you and I never met. We never really talked. And then here it is, like, I never really talked about that's what I'm doing with that stuff. And then, you know, word gets out and you're like, oh yeah, you know, you helped out someone in the folk punk world with funds. And I don't know, it always blows my mind because people, whether you announce that stuff, and I don't think you necessarily should or have to, but like people become aware of when you're trying to help others get to where they're going. And, you know, I was just an example of that.
That is one of the biggest things. It's actually kind of funny. So the Chesky's band Codefendants has Sam King in it. And I was going through some old photos and me and Chesky were just hanging out like 2 days ago. And I was like, you know, I'm pretty sure I met Sam when I was like just getting into punk. And I think he actually impacted me extremely, like a lot on my ethos. And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, I didn't have a lot of money and told the band that I really liked their shit. And I'm pretty sure that Sam went out to their car and just gave me this Get Dead CD and signed it. And that act of kindness gave me the ethos of like, you know, there's a lot of people that would get into this stuff if they could just have access to it. And this was before, you know, streaming was super popular. So you couldn't just like look up the stuff. And all the early things that I would do with Punk with a Camera was I was with my friend McKenna from high school. And she was like, we were like a team where I would find the people, do the video work, and she would do the audio. And we actually released a ton of albums for free. Like Escape from the Zoo's Killicopter was recorded in McKenna's house in my bedroom, and a couple of other albums and all the DIY sessions, and we would burn those CDs and we'd charge them on the website. But like if you were ever at a show, it was just free. There was just like this little DIY like free box of like all these CDs, and I would tell bands, I'm like, send me your stickers, send me your CDs, and I'll put them in my free box. And I still try to vocalize that still, like, hey, if you send me stickers to my PO box, like we send stuff out all the time. And I think it's so important that like just that random act that Sam gave me where he gave me this CD to this 17-year-old punk kid, I'm like, That affected me so much. And I told him later, and he's like, I won't tell anyone that you were actually there for Anti-Flag. And I'm like, ah. But yeah, no, I giving, you know, and that's what led to me wanting to do the distro the way that I do, because the bands that are on my distro get 80% of all net sales. Like we only take a 20% cut to do everything that we do. And I went to school to be an accountant and never wanted to be, but I used the skills to create accountability check sheets, because the amount of times that I had heard from people like Matt Pless, I remember was the earliest, was he would talk about how Driftwood Records would try to steal all of his stuff. And I remember at one point, I think it's Driftwood, but some record label that was really shisty. Or is shisty the right word? Like shady?
Yeah, shisty, either one.
I don't, Okay, I'm gonna make sure I'm using the right diction. But you know, at one point they were like, "Oh, can you give us the login to your YouTube?" And I'm like, "The fuck? Absolutely the hell not." And just like telling, I'd be like, "Hey, you know, they pressed your stuff, they're doing your stuff. Like, are you getting any transparency or information throughout that?" And Matt was like, "No." And I'm like, "Well, why would you let somebody do that?" You know, like this big thing of like talking with bands and realizing that a lot of labels will put up, you know, the Spotify streaming, and I would see ad revenue from YouTube, and I would understand how beneficial that was for me, and like go over to this band I really liked who was like struggling, and I'm like, "Well, let me make your shirts, and you know, you could help figure out money stuff." And the biggest thing was like so many people were never taught on financial literacy and like what to do and how to survive, so they would like do their passion and get burnt out because they have to go back to work and they have to pay their rent and they have to do all this other stuff, but they already have all this like cultural success and this cult following, and I'm just like, you should be making hundreds, if not thousands of dollars from your streaming services. What's going on there? Like, you know, you should have merchandise figured out. You're signed with these labels. Like, you know, what's going on there? And a lot of people would be like, "Well, they take a big cut, or they don't give us any transparency, or they'll give us like bi-yearly checks." And I'm like, "Okay, but do you get the information on data analytics or how things are translating? Like, at the end of the day, this is all your stuff. This is all the stuff you produced and other people are benefiting from it." And that was the big thing that made me want to make what I only assume is the current, you know, for the profit of the artist distro, which is like, "Hey, I went to school for accounting. I'm going to do monthly spreadsheets. This is where everything's sold. This is the things that are happening. These are the things that are going through." And I would talk to bands who don't have the rights to their music. And I'm like, "Let's see what we can do to get your masters back." Because there's no reason, at the end of the day, artists are just working class people that are being taken advantage of, folks who understand finances and understand money and understand what's going on. And there is a right to fight for comfortability, because there's no reason that the money that you should be making through streaming that would pay your rent, that would make you in a comfortable financial situation, that would allow you to be able to go on tour more or make more art. But instead, you know, you're working two jobs like I did when I was 17, you know, that's weird. That's just unacceptable. And to see that, you know, you're like, "Hey, I know, you know, Pat gave me the right to Johnny Hobo, but, you know, I just sent Littlefoot $600 for gas because, you know, he was stranded on the side of the road and he's doing the shit and he just needs that help. And what do I need this for?" That's beautiful. I feel like the transparency to invest into your community is the most important thing, because like one of the biggest things that I took away from schooling and learning about, especially like crime, is there's only white collar crime. The only time that you have crime is the lack of economic opportunity. And, you know, it's just unfair that so many people just get taken advantage of, that get their shit stolen from them, that don't have the rights. And it's not like it's not making money. It's making money and they're just told that it's not. And to deal with it. And that sucks.
Yeah, when I used to run the DIY Bandits label, I mean, that was a big thing for me. You know, we never had contracts. We gave hugs instead of handshakes, and we wrote letters instead of contracts. But I told every band, like, "It's your music. You do what you want." I never took streaming from it. I said, "You put it up, you keep 100%. I wanted the bands to have that control over what they did. And, you know, to any point, I mean, even now, Lost Dog Street Band, you know, I put out the two earlier bands that Ben was in, and, you know, and he hit me up recently and he's like, "Listen, I'm trying to get control over everything." And I never had control over it, but he's asked me to take it down. I was like, "Yeah, sure." You know, we just had it on Bandcamp and we took it off Bandcamp. You know, that's my stance on all that stuff. Like, I always tell people, it's your music. You should be able to do what you want with it. You know, it's a shame that, like you said, bands don't own their masters. It just, I don't know. I get it. It's the business world, but it blows my mind. Like, it just doesn't seem like the right way things should be, especially like in this DIY world that we're operating in.
Yeah. It's not like it's a lot of money either. It's, you know, the masters to this thing might be another $1,000 a month to a big company, but $1,000 a month to a regular person is life-changing. I still try to bring up the conversation with Jay from Crywank about Victory Records, because I've pressed them about pressing the Dog album a lot, and he's like, I don't own them. And I'm like, well, you know, I've even like reached out and given them to like contacts to like music lawyers and stuff like that. I'm like, dude, there's got to be like, because Victory got sold to somebody else and the rights to it is in limbo. And I think it's the same with actually a couple other like big punk bands where they're like, "Oh, we just never pressed it because we didn't have the legal rights to." And I'm like, fuck. You know, like, you're not seeing streaming on the shit that you created. You're not having the opportunity to make merchandise out of it to make your life better. And it's not like the people who listen to music wouldn't want this. Like, I'd love to have, what's that band called? No Cash. You don't want to, oh, No Cash. Yeah. That first album, they don't own it. And he's never pressed it because of it. And I'm like, what the hell?
When I was locked up here, this kind of just gets on the topic of, I guess we were talking about like helping people get to where they are. And, you know, some people might say, especially someone who's just mainly interested in the business side of things, like, well, you should take what you can and get the most for yourself, you know, as a label or anything, and you're going to end up better financially. You know, and that might be the story that's told. You know, and look, I ran a DIY Bandits for 16 years. I could have made money, but I gave it all to the bands, and I never made a profit until I got locked up. And I made a decent amount of money. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, we put out these benefit records for me when I was locked up, and I'm so grateful to Pat. Like, $50,000 in legal fees was paid for, and then money to get through on my commissary, like to eat when I was in there. And I read this book in there called Give and Take, and it was by this guy, Adam Grant. And it was just mostly referring to like more of the corporate world, like bigger companies. But he was talking about these companies that the owners or the CEOs were really helpful in giving with the company. And in the beginning of the book, you're reading about those companies and they often fail. And then you hear the stories of these other companies where the owners or CEOs really like kind of all for themselves and greedy, and they're like successful in making all this money. But then at the end of the book, it goes and it looks into the situation, and those who are really giving, they moved on to other projects where they received so much support, financial and otherwise, from the people that they helped in those earlier projects that maybe didn't succeed. And when I saw it, and I was like, oh, this is exactly what happened to me. Like, for 16 years, I made nothing. If anything, I lost money. And then here I am. And it really helped me feel more comfortable with like the funds I received from those benefits when I was locked up, because it was a weird thing for me to think, man, this is like $60,000. And I still owe legal funds, you know, and people money, but like almost everything was paid for. And the idea that you could be so giving and maybe things might not work out, but in the long run, if you look over the arc of history, people who do that seem to have more benefits in the end.
Oh yeah. Well, and not only that, they're really the biggest thing that I take away with like talking to these bands that I'm like, you need to own your masters. You need to have the rights to sell your merchandise. You need to have transparency if you're going through a third party company to press your stuff, is that we have so much guilt associated with us of working class people, of handouts or whatever you want to call that. I remember dating somebody and I was like, look, I'm set up to where I know I won't be able to get EBT, but hey, you know, if you did, that'd be amazing because I, you know, I know where you're at. And she's like, I don't want to do no food stamps or whatever. And I'm like, it's free money, you know, like, and to some people that it's so ingrained in them that that's like guilty or wrong or whatever. But in reality, like, dude, we're all just ants. And the people who run this shit have the magnifying glass. And if you want to complain that the ant in front of you is getting it a little bit easier to you, then you're not realizing that you're about to get fucking cooked.
The thing that sucks is a lot of us in this DIY punk world, you know, we have this allergy to capitalism, which I totally understand and agree with. The downside is, well, we live in this capitalist system where we have to depend on money, and we're often so uncomfortable talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
And like understanding it. And, you know, the perfect example, it was just funny. I remember when I first started giving away the Johnny Hobo funds, it was at the time when Pigeon Pit and Apes of the State were trying to go over to Australia. And I had called April, Apes of the State, and I was like, hey, I can help you guys out if you or Pigeon Pit need some funds. And April's like, I think it's all going to work out because they did some benefits and stuff. But she said, you know, Littlefoot is actually in the middle of something right now, and they can definitely use some help. I got in touch with Littlefoot. I was like telling him, because he was like almost uncomfortable with it, or he was uncomfortable. I was like, listen, I'll just give you the money. Like, it's cool. Like, just tell me what you need to get through the rest of tour.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, and it was like a hard conversation, and I get it. And I mean, look, I've dealt with large sums of money when I was illegally selling marijuana. I mean, we had a big operation, like we bought an airplane and stuff.
Jesus. Badass.
But I mean, that was even for me, like that beginning from when I was just selling small amounts. And then as it began to grow, like I felt bad as I began to become successful, quote unquote, in that world and just having access to funds. I mean, you know, and I gave away so much and I've helped a lot of stuff. But the reality is we live in this world where money plays an important role. There's no denying it.
Oh, yeah.
And if somebody has access to it, you know, and Pat would say I should pay some of my own fines or whatever. But, you know, the way I see it is that's not really my money. It's not my pocket money. So, like, funds from that, like, I want to give it away. And it's funny. It's like I have a hard time giving it away sometimes. You know, I want to give it to, the, like, this community. Yeah, I wish it was something that we were more comfortable dealing with.
There's, like, this strange guilt associated with money or like what you can be doing. Thank you, Nolan. And it's defeating because it shouldn't be such a roadblock. Like you shouldn't reach a point past, you know, doing your hobbies to where you're like, well, I don't deserve to do this because I feel guilty about it. Or I don't, you know, no, you should think about doing it bigger and better and trying to do more things, you know, like, and this is just coming from somebody who wants to be a filmmaker. You know, that is not a cheap fucking hobby to be into, let alone, you know, music isn't a cheap hobby to be into either. You know, a cheap vinyl press is like $5,000. A good touring run can cost you tens of thousands, if not even more, of money. And you have to figure a way to create those funds and be realistic with them without pandering to people and find your true self and not feel guilty in what you want to do. Because at the end of the day, everything that I'm making creates opportunity not only for myself, but the people who are working for me, the people who want to collaborate with me. I mean, even like right now, when I press a record, my deal is pretty cut and dry. It's like, look, I'm going to front everything. And when we post up the sale, we're going to work together on doing a marketing campaign to sell the stuff. And hopefully we're going to cover the necessities of the front within the first couple of days. And my cutback from it is I'm going to take 20% of the units that I cannot physically sell until yours are picked up or sold out. And once the front money goes through those first sales, we go back to our normal 80-20 split and you're paid out. And there's fucking accounting records and there's transparency and there's everything else. And I'm even doing it a step further right now with Sister Wife Sex Strike. I just paid for their new album to be mastered and we're going to press their new album. Or not mastered, the mixed, and then next is mastering. And to do that, we're working together on like, okay, how do we, you know, market these things to get to your fans who want to buy this shit anyway, so we can just get the stupid funds that cause the roadblock to make the things happen. The album is recorded. It just needs to be mixed, mastered, and then we'll press it. But that is such a difficult roadblock to so many people when they're like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to come up with $10,000. You know, it was like a little over $2,000 to mix and master. It's going to be probably $6,000 to press the records and, you know, whatever in between with costs for packaging and everything else. And to like a normal person, that's terrifying. But to someone where I'm like, well, look, we can work together. We can figure it out. This is the transparency of it. And you shouldn't feel guilty that, you know, you want to do this. You want to put a good album out. So just take the resources that are available to you and work towards them and understand that like none of this is fucking capitalistic. You know, we're selling this for the benefit of commerce and to create the next fucking thing, because unfortunately we live in a society with money. We'll never truly be free as long as money is what controls everything, but we can live in some level of sphere of understanding that there are working class people that can benefit from all this shit, that can do the things in a way that's economical. You don't have to go through the cheapest fucking press that's going to use the wrong shit. You don't have to print on $4 t-shirts and sell them at a premium of like $35. You can go and get economically friendly inks. You can go and get sweatshop free stuff. You can go and get people who are paid a fair labor, and you can go and vocalize that these are the ethics and morals that you want to put into this world and still be successful in a sense as far as monetary stuff goes. Because at the end of the day, we got to pay fucking rent. We got to have a place to live. We have to have our basic needs met. And we live in a society that runs on money. And figuring out and understanding financial literacy is one of the most important things that you have to do as an artist, because it's not a fucking, it's not a game once it stops being a hobby. It's a business. And you got to not feel guilty about the fact that, you know, you might become successful. And you got to understand that once you get to that point, you have to figure out how to keep it going and growing it properly and taking the steps together in a way that is not, you know, shady, that is not unfair, that does do the things morally correct. And that's what separates capitalism from commerce and what we do to what they do. I just think that that's probably one of the most important things. And I'm sorry if I'm rambling. I suck at staying on topic. But yeah, at the end of the day, financial literacy is not taught well enough, and people feel guilty that they're being successful. And nobody should feel guilty that they should be successful. They should be proud. They should be proud of what they've accomplished, where they've come, where they've grown, what they're able to do with what they are producing through their own means, and who they're able to help and benefit, whether it's, you know, a kid who's like, oh man, your album saved my life, or somebody who, because you needed to print all these t-shirts or whatever, their fucking paycheck was paid this week, you know, through the success of what you're doing. Or you, yourself, being able to take in the remaining profits of everything that you've earned and said, oh, you know what sounds really cool? We've been using a 2004 Toyota Camry to tour in for 10 years. Why don't we finally get a Sprinter van? Or why don't we rent something that's useful? Why don't we take the benefit from our production and put it into something useful? And we're not going to have these capitalists take our surplus labor value and have it in their pockets. It's in our pockets, and we can do whatever the fuck we want with it. We can go and get a house. We can go and go get a lease on this thing. We can go on this bigger tour to a different place because we have taken the time to not feel guilty and understand that at the end of the day, you can do this in your basement forever. But, you know, I've met a lot of people who have 500,000 followers on Spotify and have all this shit, and they don't have any rights to their music, and they're struggling, and they're in this corner. And at the end of the day, true collective ownership of whatever you make is the most important step in furthering success to comfortability. At the end of the day, I don't want to be a millionaire, but I would like to ensure that I have a roof over my head and my mortgage paid. And I'm going to do that through the means of my own art and the benefits that come with owning the means of my production and owning the rights to the things that I create. And there's not going to be some third party or person who won't even tell me like, oh, well, this is what we made this month off of your work, of your hard work, of your production, and just go from there. Like, too many artists are starving artists because people take advantage of them, and it's disgusting. And if there's anything that I can put out into this world, it's you don't have to always be taken advantage. Just somebody telling you like, hey, we'll give you 50 grand for the rights to this album, or you could take, you know, a lower paycheck, but you have ownership. Always take that ownership, dude. That 50 grand will go away. Like, you know, you said you got 60 grand in the funds for whatever, you know, it's amazing how quickly that can be spent on fines. And then it's gone.
So we've been talking for a while, and we're going to close out here. I wanted to talk to you about animals. You once had a 5-foot snake. Is that true?
I still do.
You still do? What kind of snake?
It's a ball python. I've had it since middle school. His name's Slash. He's about 15 years old now. And it's my best friend.
How long are they expected to live?
If you take care of them, they can go up to 40 years. And so I get so stressed out when people are like, yeah, my ball python died. They're like, how old was it? 4? And I'm like, Jesus Christ, what type of neglect were you putting into this thing? They don't need much. You just change their water, make sure they have humidity and heat, and feed them once a month. You're good. Well, once they get big enough, of course.
Does it get bigger than 5 feet, or is that like the general?
She's actually pretty big for her size. The ball python's a smaller reticulating constrictor. But, you know, you get into these other ones, and they can get up to 10, 20 feet. But there's a certain point in which that's a wild animal versus something that could be reasonably maintainable. But then in the same breath, you know, a snake is a wild animal, and maybe I shouldn't even have it in a cage, you know? But as far as statistics go, Slash is a very large female for her species.
I guess in closing, I just want to ask about platypus.
Dude, they're the coolest fucking thing in the world. Like, I have never felt more connected to a weird animal because they're just so different yet unique and special. I got to see one for the first time ever in Australia on tour right before COVID. I don't know. I've always identified with platypus. They're weird, but they're surviving. You know, they've got a duck bill, but they lay eggs. They've got a poison thing that'll fucking kill you, and they glow green under UV light. And like Perry the platypus, that's the right green. He guessed that. That was fucking insane. But my animal that I've always like loved is a platypus because I just think that they're so unique and different. They're weird in a good way. And I feel like I'm weird in a good way.
Yeah, I never knew that they were venomous. My kid recently like sent me a list of facts about platypus, and that was one of them on there. I had no idea that they have a venom, and that there's something on their foot, right? I think they have something on their foot. Or is it just the males that are venomous?
Yeah, it's just the males from my understanding. Recently, they found out that they glow under UV light, and it's the same color green that Perry the platypus is.
Man, we talked quite a bit and we can talk more. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. I mean, I kind of reached out to you kind of last minute because we had a logistical issue. Usually we give people a little more time, but you were willing to get on here and thank you. You've been requested as a guest on here, so I'm glad to finally have you on.
Yeah. And if you ever want me back or if you ever need feedback or advice, I mean, any friend of Chesky is a good person in my book, and I hope to be honored with your friendship over time. And yeah, just I hope things are well with you, and holler at me if you ever need anything.
Definitely. Yeah. Hopefully once I'm off probation and I'm allowed to leave my state, we run into each other at some point out in Texas.
Yeah, I'd love that. If you ever want to go shoot guns or something, let me know. We've been getting into making gun range targets lately.
Nice. Yeah, we'll definitely stay in touch. Thank you again for coming on.
Be safe.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Back in the Grind. If you want to offer support and get some bonus materials, you can join our Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/backonthegrind. There's a link in the episode show notes. And feel free to send us an email at podcast@backonthegrindrecords.com or through Instagram. Both of those have links in the show notes as well. And if you want some good organic coffee, check out banditcoffeeroasters.com. It's the project I planned while I was in prison and started now that I'm out. You can get coffee that I roasted myself mailed directly to your house. There's a subscription offer as well. In the future, I will be changing the name, but for now, it's still up and running and there will be no disruptions with any orders or subscriptions. Also, we're coming up on 1 year of doing this podcast. We're going to do an episode about that, what it was like, what we would have done differently, what's changing going forward, what it's meant to us, and what it's meant to you as a listener. We've gotten plenty of great messages since we started, but if there's anything you want to share with us, if you want to tell us something you've liked or didn't like about the podcast, if you want to share how the podcast helped you in a positive way, we'd love to hear about it. Send us an email and we can talk about it in an upcoming episode. Or if you have any questions or topic suggestions, feel free to send those our way too. If there's things you want to do in your life, get started and stay free until next time.